Welcome to the Canteen Podcast, a show for anyone who has feelings about food. Join host Ali Houston as guests open up about their relationship with food and their thoughts on nutrition. Nourish yourself with the Canteen Podcast.
Hey everyone, welcome to this episode of the Canteen Podcast. I'm your host Ali Houston. Our guest today is Professor Tim Noakes. He's a decorated scientist and best-selling author. He's got a lot of amazing stuff to say, including some history on Atkins and Ansel Keys, what he eats now, and how public nutrition can be improved. I hope you enjoy. Please don't forget to jump over to iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts and hit the subscribe button. And please don't forget to leave a 5-star rating and review to get the podcast in front of more eyes. This podcast is made possible thanks to paleocanteen.co.uk, which is my company. Paleocanteen.co.uk is the UK's one-stop paleo and low-carb food provider, where you can get restaurant-quality meals, grass-fed Scottish beef and lamb, and outdoor-bred pork delivered chilled to your door. That's paleocanteen.co.uk. Thanks, and enjoy the show. All right, we're live, and today we're honoured to have Professor Tim Noakes, who is a South African scientist, an emeritus professor in the Division of Exercise Science and Sports Medicine at the University of Cape Town. He's also a member of the National Research Foundation of South Africa, who list him as one of their highest rated members for research. He's run more than 70 marathons and ultramarathons and is the author of several books on exercise and diet. He's known for his work in sports science and for his support of a low-carbohydrate, high-fat diet, as set out in his books, The Real Meal Revolution and Lore of Nutrition, Challenging Conventional Dietary Beliefs. He's also the founder of the Noakes Foundation, a non-profit corporation founded for public benefit, which aims to advance medical science's understanding of the benefits of a low-carb, high-fat diet by providing evidence-based information on optimum nutrition that is free from commercial agenda. Thank you so much for joining us, Tim.
My pleasure. Thanks, Ali. Lovely to be with you.
So I first came to hear about you through my old professor. I started studying a PhD in physics that I didn't complete, mainly because I spent more time studying nutrition in the end than physics. And my professor at the time, he'd healed himself from chronic fatigue syndrome, ME, by simply changing the way he ate. And he's actually coming on the podcast as well soon. A very clever man and someone who I had a lot of respect for. And I was kind of dabbling with changing my diet to improve my health at the time, and we're talking around 2016. And he started to, you know, I was getting more interested in nutrition. And so when the subject of food ever came up, I would hear him say the most outlandish things, you know, like margarine isn't food, or 5 a day is just made up out of thin air and there's no real good evidence to support it. You know, whole grains, there's no good evidence that that they're particularly good for you. And I was kind of taken aback because, you know, these are things that you just hold to be true because you've heard them over and over again in the mainstream and from eminent people. But he pointed me towards various sources for information that I could make my own mind up. And yourself was one of the sources. And then he brought you to my attention again when you went through your trial. Yeah, so for people who haven't heard about that, in February 2014, there was a registered dietitian complained to the Health Professions Council of South Africa about a tweet that you'd made. And I'm sure you're sick of talking about it, but I watched the YouTube videos of your trial and the brilliant moment where you were completely vindicated. And so maybe you could just briefly touch on that.
I think it 2013 when we wrote the book The Real Meal Revolution, which said exactly what you've said. It said that these things are not true, and that the way you get healthy is to eat a high-fat diet made of real foods. And that changed the landscape about the debate on nutrition in South Africa. And all of a sudden, the dietitians had to defend what they'd been doing for 50 years from scrutiny. And so people would ask, but I've lost weight eating this high-fat diet, and you tell me it's dangerous. Where's the evidence? And as a result, the one or two dietitians decided they better take action against me. And they're looking for any reason. And then there was this tweet in which I responded to and gave some information to a mother. We don't know if she was breastfeeding or not, but the point was she asked a wee question. She said, babies and mothers. And so therefore, there's no doctor-patient relationship. I'm just giving advice. And I gave the standard South African dietary guidelines advice that is best to wean onto the low-carb, high-fat diet, i.e. onto meat and fish and dairy and eggs and vegetables, which is absolutely correct. Anyway, they colluded with the Health Professions Council, and because I was a medically trained doctor, I'm registered with them, and so I'm answerable to them, and then they colluded to make a charge against me. Even though there was no harm done, no one took the advice. The mother actually laughed when she read that. She said, well, that's ridiculous. I'd never do that to my son. So the case should have been thrown out, but it went on for 4 years. And what we did was we put the diet on trial. It wasn't about me in the end. It was about the diet. And we were vindicated fully, as you indicated. So it was an amazing moment for me. It was very tough. It was financially very hard, but emotionally it was shocking because my own university had excommunicated me, my profession had excommunicated me, I'd been academically mobbed, I was mobbed on social media. There was clearly a campaign of 5 or 6 people who were trolling me all the time persistently. But one of the key people in the trial, after it was over, she said to me, Tim, you've got to get down on your knees every day and thank your university. And thank the Health Professional Council for what they did for you. They put you through hell, but they took you to a different level. And she said you advanced the cause of the low carbs in a way that would have taken years, and it happened in weeks. So she said, don't be angry, don't be hostile. You know, you were successful, and what you've done could never happen without this going through this trial. So I'm very thankful for what happened. It was tough, but... it's over, and it'll have very long-term good consequences for the low-carb diet.
Wow, yeah, I think that's an amazing attitude, given how hard that must have been, sort of day in, day out, really wondering not just about financially how you were, but, I mean, your legacy as your whole career was... on the line, and what people thought of you in the future. And it's great to see that you've got so many people following you for information now that wouldn't have known about you were it not for the trial. And it seems to be quite a common theme in these days, the attacks on public figures, especially if there's a counterculture element to it, seem to backfire quite heavily. And I think in this case, it's a really good thing because it's, like you say, it's resulted in so much publicity.
Absolutely. And, you know, the ultimate irony is that the Department of Nutrition and Dietetics at the University of Cape Town is going to be closed.
Really?
Yeah. And I don't know why it is, but they were so strongly involved in the case. So the university, instead of apologizing to me, has just closed down to teaching of dietetics.
Dear me.
They realized that they were teaching a load of rubbish.
Wow. Yeah, you think they might... well, this is actually something that I'm really interested in. So, you know, you're a huge advocate, as I am, of taking anecdotes seriously. And you quite often talk about... The case of the smallpox vaccine and Edward Jenner, who noticed that milkmaids weren't getting smallpox and developed the first vaccine off the back of that. And what I really wanted to ask about what we were just talking about was, given the lag between anecdote to case study to trial to guideline and textbook change, that can take 10 or 20 years. Can you see a way to speed up the process so that the next generation of healthcare professionals, scientists, the public can be well informed and act in a way that is going to be good for their health without needing to wait 20 years for the wrong answer?
Yeah. Well, the answer is the evidence is all in the, it's all in the literature, and it was probably in the literature in the 1920s. You know, when you look far enough back, they were using low carb diets to treat and indeed reverse diabetes in the 1920s. So it's not that there isn't the evidence. The evidence is there, but it just is hidden. And some people accepted it and used it and practiced it. So hundreds of thousands of people have been on this diet over the years, and there's never been any evidence that they've been damaging their health. If they had, it would have come out. Quite the contrast, it seems that they've been extremely healthy. I think the problem is that we're up against industry and the pharmaceutical industry, the science industry, the food industry. It's all there, and they are protecting themselves. And so we have to go to each individual and just educate them and say, listen, this is the evidence. You must decide what you want to do. The one beauty is, you know, if you wanted to prove that vaccines were damaging, it would take you 40, 50, 60 years. And you, as an individual, could never prove it because how would you know it wasn't other things? But on a diet, you know, within a week, you know whether it's going to benefit you or not. And that's why it's an unstoppable viral change, because individuals will find out very quickly if they're healthier on this diet or not. And that's why it's unstoppable. It's the only intervention where you see the results very, very quickly.
Yeah, that's a great point. And it's something that, kind of, even though I had looked at all the sources myself from a scientific background after, being pointed towards them from Ken Strain, my old professor, I was still left wondering on all this butter, cheese, eggs, meat, when my heart would explode, you know, in spite of the fact that the extra weight I had melted away and stayed off, in spite of the fact that I had more energy and better sleep than ever, in spite of the fact that my skin looked good, my mental health was vastly improved. You know, even under those conditions, I was thinking, when's it going to go wrong?
Yeah. No, that's right. So you know, I'm just currently researching where it went all wrong, and everyone focused on Ansel Keys and the epidemiological research, and it turned out that when he came along, the reason why the things changed so quickly was people just accepted this associational research as being the truth. Had they understood that association studies can never prove causation, they might have been more reluctant to accept. But anyway, that's the point they did. But the real effect was that if you go back to the 50s, people knew that diabetes causes arterial disease, and they knew that diabetics have high triglyceride levels, not high cholesterol levels. So there was a whole push that you understanding triglyceride metabolism, and then it turned out that it was carbohydrate-sensitive hypertriglyceridemia. So they understood that it was carbohydrates that were driving the diabetes and driving the fatty liver and the high triglycerides, and that was linked to heart disease. So that was the root. But along comes Keys with, he doesn't take a biochemical approach. He takes this nutritional associational studies. And then we go, oops, it's not diabetes and triglycerides, it's cholesterol. And the reality is that if you look hard enough, you've got to go right back to that point, and then you realize where we've got it wrong. And that the high carbohydrate diet would cause diabetes. It would cause the obesity epidemic, which it did. And it didn't prevent heart disease. So we now realize that we got it wrong. And I think there's enough evidence now that we took the wrong curve, the path along. Then we took the wrong path. And if we take the triglyceride diabetes path and not the cholesterol path, we would have been fine. So now we just got to get back on the diabetes triglyceride path as the cause of arterial disease.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And you were speaking there about Ansel Keys, who was a researcher through the, I think, from the 30s maybe and onwards, and he was quite prominent by the time that this question came up. And there was him and who wrote the book Pure, White and Deadly again?
Yeah, John Yadkin in the United Kingdom, yeah.
John Yadkin was a very well-respected academic, and he wrote the book Pure, White and Deadly, blaming sugar for the increasing problems with obesity. And
you're quite correct. Now, I've looked at the American linkages, and I need to go back because he promoted the low-carb diet for weight loss. And I need to look at whether he understood it was also preventing heart disease or not. And, you know, it'll be very interesting to see. Of course, he said sugar is causing heart disease. So presumably he would have said the low-carb diet is preventing heart disease.
Mm-hmm.
But I haven't followed that track back far enough.
Yeah. And for those who haven't heard of what Ansel Keys did, I mean, he did some really interesting work on starvation. And I think it was on conscientious objectors where he took, I mean, you couldn't do that now, but he took conscientious objectors from World War II, I think, and put them on a 1600 calorie a day diet and watched what happened to them. And they were going out of their minds very quickly, you know, within a month or so. I mean, interesting to note that the Eat Well plate in the UK is about 1800 calories a day, so it's not a million miles away. Ansel Keys went on to look at this idea that cholesterol was a primary driver potentially in heart disease. He is accused of kind of doctoring data so that the graph that you see that looks like association between saturated fat intake and heart disease is a straight line, so that the countries that were, it's called the seven nations study, they took the seven countries with data for the amount of saturated fat they were eating and the amount of heart disease they had, and it looks like a straight line, so that the more saturated fat you eat, the more heart disease you have, case closed. But then of course your graph is only as good as the data that you put in. And if you add in the other countries' data, then it doesn't look like a straight line at all. You find that there's countries that have high saturated fat intake and low heart disease and vice versa.
Absolutely, yeah. No, but it even got worse because the association studies can never prove causation anyway, so even if you find the relationship. But then he did a trial, the Minnesota Coronary Experiment, and he put people on a polyunsaturated fat diet, so they replaced their fat, saturated fat, with polyunsaturated fats. And they IA didn't do better, or they did worse. And he hid the data for about 40 years until they were recovered. And they showed that, particularly if you're over 65, changing your diet to this margarine and polyunsaturated fats, you actually did worse. And that would have killed the story right there, because that was in 1974, the trial ended. And unfortunately, it wasn't published, so he got away with it. There's also a report come out just about 2 weeks ago showing that he was involved in malaria experiments where they exposed US troops to malaria without telling them what the experiment was all about. Now, and in his experiments with fasting, there were some people who, there was one guy who cut his fingers off because he'd gone so mad, and that kind of a little bit unethical. Probably should have stopped the experiment there.
Yeah, I should say so. I'm actually just watching the HBO miniseries Chernobyl right now, and they had to do some kind of ethically questionable, almost like trolley problem things, where they had to ask these miners to, you know, dig underneath the reactor core, in spite of the fact that these people knew, you know, they knew that the people that worked close to it would die pretty soon. But the cost of not doing it was that, you know, Ukraine would have to be evacuated for 150 years or something. I mean, you wouldn't want to be in that situation. But I guess I guess Ansel Keys probably could have backed out of the experiment without too much worry. Ansel, I was going to say something else about Ansel Keys. Oh yeah, that was it. It was about academic impartiality and conflict of interest, because he said that part of the problem with getting good information to people as fast as possible is that you've got pharmaceutical interests and industry interests. Presumably you mean grain companies or, you know, companies making replacement meat or whatever. But the academic one's really interesting to me, because there's meant to be an impartiality. But what I always think is, when I see a commercial interest, I don't necessarily think there's a conflict of interest, because to me, one of the worst conflicts of interest is what you've said in the past. And people find it very difficult to divorce themselves from what they've said in the past. And they just want to stick by it, be stubborn, and not tarnish their own reputation. And I think that might even be a worse conflict of interest than money. And, you know, you're a very interesting case, I think, because you have changed your mind. You did a complete 180. I actually saw an argument on Twitter where someone used a paragraph from your book. Tucker Goodrich was telling me about this. Used a paragraph from your book saying, you know, you should read a bit of Tim Noakes. He loves carb loading for running, not realizing that you'd totally changed your mind.
That's right.
So what do you think about academic conflict of interest in that respect?
No, I think you're absolutely right. Very few people can ever say they're wrong. And to me, there was no choice, because I finally understood that what I'd written in Law of Running was going to harm patients, that some people would develop type 2 diabetes as a result of eating a high carbohydrate diet for 20 or 30 or years, as I did, and I couldn't ignore it. So I had the choice to either ignore it and say, you know, or not expose people to these new ideas, or to change. And for me, it was never a choice. I just had to be honest. You know, but I never thought that what would happen to me would happen. I assumed that people will say, gosh, he's changed his mind. That's really interesting. He must have had good reasons. But then they told the world why my reasons were wrong, without ever listening to what I was actually saying. So it surprised me, but then I begin to realize that science has been so corrupted that it's difficult to know what's the truth and what isn't. By and large, most of the published stuff is wrong, it's biased and it's incorrect, and it's marketing. It's not real. It's not really of value to us.
Yeah, and I suppose it brings back around this question of democratization of information is great. People now can, you know, just look and see what's out there. And I've got a somewhat of a science background, and so I feel somewhat qualified to dive into it a bit. But I still need guidance, because there's too many papers to read all of them, and sometimes the writing is opaque, and sometimes it's deliberately opaque, and sometimes it's just too technical. So we all need experts to disentangle information, simplify it, and give it to us in an easy to digest way. It's just choosing those experts, I think, is the vital part of that. And because you can take any, almost any issue now, go online and find one expert who seems totally credible, and then another one who seems totally credible who completely disagrees with the first one.
Absolutely, because we've all got our biases and we all look for the evidence that supports our position. I've always tried to teach my students that if there's one piece of evidence that conflicts with your theory, that is the most important evidence. And you have to look at it and you have to explain why it's wrong and you're still right. It's pointless looking for all the stuff that supports you, because you could all be wrong. But I think that firstly, this is, sorry, the second point I'd say is that biology is the answer. If you understand the biology, that'll give lead you, because you can't fake biology. You can't, you know, you can't run up to Mount Everest. It's not to the top of Mount Everest. And if you, unless you're uniquely biologically advantaged, you're not going to make it. You're going to die. You can't beat the rules of physiology and biology, and that's what you have to understand. And so I try to look at the history of this whole story, and when you look at the history of the whole story, there it is. It's very clear that we were very healthy when we were eating 40% fat and 38% carbohydrates. And then as we've increased the carbohydrates and reduced the fats and included processed foods, we become less healthy. It's, the evidence is there. People will still argue it's not there, but it is there. And humans evolved. We've got a short colon. We've got a long small bowel and a short colon. And a short colon is for animals that eat mainly meat. We're not vegetarians that need a big bowel to digest cellulose. So the bowel and our teeth are carnivore's teeth. So, you know, it's all there if you look for it.
Yeah. And from my background, the physics side, looking at the stable isotope levels in samples from people in Europe tens of thousands of years ago that show they were even more carnivorous than some wolves. You know, they almost exclusively meat.
Yeah. And I think if you come from the north of England, my parents are from Liverpool.
Oh, yeah. My girlfriend's from Liverpool.
Fantastic. Best soft football team in the world.
I wondered why you were a fan. I mean, you don't need a reason, but yeah, that's interesting.
And I'm sure your grandparents and great-grandparents were raised on animal produce in the north of England, because it was the Ice Ages weren't so long ago and we couldn't grow anything but animals.
Yeah, in Scotland it's mince and tatties is one of the classic dishes, and haggis as well. So, you know, using up all of the sheep and all of the cow.
Yeah, and blood sausages. Oh, that's delicious.
Yeah, black pudding. Yeah, I love that. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah, it's all good stuff. I mean, what do you typically eat in a day?
Quite little. I'd usually eat one meal a day, so it'll be eggs and bacon, or fish, or steak. And that's about it. You know, and I have dairy. I eat quite a lot of dairy, and I don't drink milk. I eat cream and minimal vegetables. I've kind of gone much more carnivorous now, so because I don't see the benefits of vegetables. I'm not, the story about fiber is, again, it's kind of made up, and it's, I don't see the evidence that you need much fiber.
Yeah. Yeah, I like the phrase that's going about, that the a healthy microbiome is the microbiome of a healthy person.
Yeah. I know, and that, you see, the problem is when you read the microbiome research, you just see the bias of the person who did the study. If it's a carnivore, they'll say this carnivorous diet's obviously the microbiome you need. If it's a vegetarian or vegan, they'll say that's the one you need, you know, in the people they study. Who knows? And the other point, you know, I was speaking to a bacteriologist. He said, how can you know? If you've got trillions of bacteria, how can you really know which are in the majority and which aren't? I think it's guesswork at the moment.
Yeah, it's a very, very uncertain science right now. So do you cook it all yourself, or are you the cook of the family, or what do you generally do?
I do a bit of cooking. We do braaiflees or barbecuing. I do the barbecuing of the steaks and the sausages and the lamb chops. Lamb chops is one of my favorites.
Yeah.
And I discovered recently lamb is full of omega-3s, so I was very happy about that. Otherwise, my wife does the cooking as well, yeah.
Yeah, lamb's incredible. I think lamb chops are probably, if I had to choose one food that I would only get that for the rest of my life, it would be lamb chops with ribeye steak, a close second, I think.
No, I quite agree with you. It's funny how carnivores all feel the same way about the same foods.
Yeah, it probably should tell us something.
Exactly.
It's interesting though, like When I was talking to Ken, my physics professor, about, you know, the various health problems I'd had over the years. And by the way, he was very, very clear to say that he wasn't offering me health advice. He would always point me towards information that I could make my own mind up with. But he was saying that there's people who eat, you know, no plants at all. They're zero carb, they're carnivore. And at first I thought, right, okay, you had me interested with keto and with paleo because it's plausible. It was plausible to me at the time that that's how people used to eat. But then when you say carnivore, I first thought it was crazy. And then over time, for me, keto just sort of became carnivore, more or less. I still do have excursions and eat plants from time to time. But my ideal diet is meat, fish, eggs, and, you know, some butter, and I just feel best like that, and it helps me to avoid junk food. So it's interesting to know that you've gone more and more in that direction, and it's interesting what you said about the microbiome as well. I think in the context of the scientific literature, where maybe the majority of papers are, you know, wrong, the microbiome stuff is really the Wild West, because it's so in its infancy. The only thing that you can maybe say is that there's big clinical advantages to having a healthy microbiome, whatever that is, you know, like the fecal microbial transplant, which was developed, I think, in Glasgow in Scotland, where if you get C. difficile infection in your bowel, then a transplant from someone else has, I think, 96% effectiveness at recovery, which is amazing. But also amazing is that if you're not careful who the donor is, then you can potentially get symptoms that they have that you never had. So you might be more inclined to put on weight if they are. You might be more inclined to certain mental health conditions if they are. It's really strange stuff.
That's amazing. I wasn't aware of that one. Yeah, I see there have been some deaths recently from fecal transplants, and so people are getting a bit more concerned.
Yes, I saw that too, yeah. It's not a catch-all, and it's not something that people should enter into lightly, I would have thought.
Correct.
Going back to when you first became aware of that changing the way you ate might improve your health, were you diagnosed with type 2 diabetes, and then you had to look around for solutions, or what happened?
It was just by chance. One morning, I read a book called Waterlogged, and it was quite an aggressive book, and took me 30 years. And the night I sent it, my brain said to me, you must get up tomorrow morning at 6 o'clock, and you must run, and you must not stop running, etc., etc., etc. So I did get up at 6, and I had a terrible run. And I came home, and I literally opened my emails, and there was an advert for a book called The New Atkins for the New You. And I saw it was written by Westman, Finney, and Bolick, whom I knew very well and respected as scientists. And I said, they've sold out to Atkins. How could they possibly use his name on their book? This is an utter disgrace. I am so angry. So I just drove to the local bookshop, and they had the last copy, and I read it. And within 3 hours, I said, oh my gosh, I got it all wrong. Because they had 150 studies of low-carb diets and the benefits. And so I decided by lunchtime, I said, that's it, no more carbs. And I converted. And then it really took me quite a long time before I started. My health improved so dramatically that I couldn't believe that I could be sick. I couldn't think that I might have diabetes. So eventually, after a period, I went and decided, okay, well, let's have some testing. And I discovered my fasting glucose was high, even though I was now on the low-carb diet. And so then eventually I spoke to people I trusted, and they said, no, you need to go on to metformin, and I made the diagnosis, went on to metformin, and I've improved virtually every year since then. My control has improved. And now, although I continue to take metformin, I've just been using 24-hour glucose monitoring, and my average glucose is 5.2. I mean, you know, for to be a diabetic and have an average glucose, 24-hour glucose of 5.2 over 10 days is astonishing. So I'm cured, but I still must take my medication, and I must still eat this diet. If I were to change, I would just be diabetic. Within days, I'd be diabetic again.
Mm-hmm.
But I actually could not believe the results. So it's been astonishing how much I continue to improve. And it's clear the less carbohydrates I eat, and I mean, I'm talking about a few grams a day, you know, make a difference. So I recently cut out all milk, which I was having, the only milk I was having in cappuccino, and that made a difference. And so when you're diabetic and you've got, your insulin doesn't work and you still can't secrete enough, you've just got to keep the carbs out of the system completely. And then the other thing I found is running makes a huge difference. If my control the next day after a run is fantastic. Even probably if I was to run 2 hours a day, I wouldn't need medication, but I don't have the inclination or I don't have the body to run 2 hours a day. But that also is a big factor as well.
Mm-hmm. You brought up Atkins there, who many people will know, but some won't. And he was the most popular, probably in the late 20th century, doctor in America who advocated eating a low carbohydrate diet. And he died, and it was due to an accident where he fell on an icy road and hit his head, and through complications retained a lot of water weight in the last few days of his life. And this is all documented in the coroner's report, I believe. But what was taken from his weight gain was used by people who didn't want Atkins' message to be popular, and said that he was actually obese because of following the diet that he recommended. And, you know, what do you think that says about his place in the scientific community at the time?
Yeah, for those who are interested, I write a column for CrossFit, the CrossFit magazine, CrossFit website. And I'm just working on the stories about insulin resistance. And it turns out Atkins is quite important. So Atkins in 1963 is watching television and he sees the assassination of John F. Kennedy. And at the time, he's a physician, he's about 33 years old, and he's fat and he's depressed. And he says, I have to do something about this. And the assassination depresses him even more and says, I've got to lose weight. But he says, I've tried every diet and they all made me hungry. I will only do a diet that doesn't make me hungry. So he goes to the library and he works out, why do you get hungry when you're starving and fasting and so on? And he finds studies showing that starvation and fasting and low carb diets all produce the same result. They reduce ketosis and they take away your appetite within 24 hours. So he said, aha, maybe if I fasted, but I can't fast all day, so maybe if I eat a low carb diet. So he does. And then he discovers the work of Viljamar Stefansson, who was a guy who went to the Arctic and lived with the Inuit, and then came back to New York and said, listen, I'm not going to eat the rubbish food you're eating. I want to eat what the Inuit are eating. So they said, but you'll be dead in 3 weeks. So they put him on an experiment which lasts a year, and he eats only meat and he does very well. And Stefansson meets a guy called Donaldson. Blake Donaldson, who's a doctor, who's treating fat cardiacs, is what he called them. And Donaldson listens to him and says, gosh, maybe I should try my fat diabetics on your diet, which is meat for breakfast, lunch, supper, 3 servings of meat with 1 portion of fruit or veg a day. And that becomes the Donaldson diet. And Donaldson doesn't write, but he talks. And one day he's giving a lecture at the New York Hospital and a guy called Pennington hears him, and Pennington says, gosh, let's try this diet also on our diabetic, obese diabetic patients. And he does, and he describes the Pennington diet, which then becomes popular in the 1950s. So Atkins reads all this and he says, okay, I'm going on a low carb diet. And he does, and he loses 20 pounds within 6 weeks. And he says, this is the answer, and he sets up his own clinic. But he never does any research. And in the 1990s, Eric Westman, who wrote the book that changed my life, has patients come to him and say, listen, Dr. Westman, have you heard of this guy Atkins? We've tried his diet, it's amazing. And he says, yeah, but the diet's going to kill you from the high cholesterol and so on. So he says, but doc, check my cholesterol. It does, and he finds the cholesterol's normal. So instead of saying that and ignoring it, Westman goes to Atkins, he goes to his clinic, and he looks around and he's impressed by what he sees. But then he says to Atkins, this isn't good enough, you have to have data. So Atkins says, but how do I get data? So Westman says, you give me the money, I'll do the clinical trials. And they agree, and he publishes his first paper in 2002, showing substantial weight loss on the diet. He goes back to Atkins, he says, listen, we did this amazing study, it really works. So Atkins says, yeah, that's fine, we don't need any more studies. So Westman says, no, we do. We need a study on diabetics. So he does a study on diabetics, and he publishes in 2005, and this is the first study in the world that I can find showing reversal of diabetes on this diet, reversal of type 2 diabetes, and shows clear reversal in some people. And the paper gets completely hidden. No one reads it. No one takes any notice. Until Volek and Finney start researching with Westman, and they start looking at the effects of carbohydrate restriction in metabolic syndrome, and they show reversal of metabolic syndrome. So the three of them now have actually proved that you can reverse diabetes and you can reverse metabolic syndrome with a low carbohydrate diet. But they've only got small studies and no one's taken them seriously. So one day Steve Finney is working with a guy called Sami Inkinen, who's a very good athlete, who's a billionaire, who's retired, who's 35, and has insulin resistant and is wondering what to do with the rest of his life. So it turns out he and his wife are planning to row from San Francisco to Hawaii. And that's why they're with Steve Finney. They're saying, Steve, we don't want to eat carbs on this. So Steve's convincing them that they can do it without carbs, which of course they do. But in the process of the discussion, Steve and Jeff Volek say to Sami, you know, we'd like to study 100 patients with diabetes and reverse their diabetes, but we don't have the wherewithal, the support. Would you be able to help us? We've kind of got this committee together. We've got a bit of a business going. So Sami Inkinen comes back the next day and says, this is sure, I'm going to help you, but we're going to reverse diabetes in 100 million people. So they say, what? So he said, no, I will raise the funds to put together a company to reverse diabetes in 100 million. So they formed the company 4 years ago, and they've now published their second year data showing reversal in about 50 to 60% of people, and 90% of people get off insulin. And this is the defining moment. So without Atkins, you wouldn't have had Sami Inkinen. You wouldn't have had Virta Health. So it turns out Atkins is critically, critically important to this whole process. And ironically, although he didn't do the science, he funded the science that led to the solution of the problem. So he has a very important place in history. His problem was that he loved women, and it's very well described. He had a couple of addictions, and one was women, and the other one was he didn't always follow his own diet. Yeah. So he was not a thin man. He was always a little bit chubby if you look at him, but he wasn't as obese as the other people tried to suggest. But the point was, he didn't always stick to his own in diet. But he made a huge contribution. Without him, it would have taken another 10, 15 years to make the breakthrough.
It's an amazing story.
Yeah.
You touched on a point there about him not always being able to follow his own diet. And that's a really interesting point for me, because I'm kind of all or nothing, and I can't really sugar or you know, veg oils or starchy carbs in moderation. I just can't do it. I can't have one donut and leave it alone like I've been told that I'm meant to be able to. But I think that there's some nutritionists who are big advocates of low carbohydrate who make the point that there's some people who need to be able to have cheat days, if you like, or to eat these things sometimes in order to stick to the diet mostly. And so what's your take on it? And do you think there's an easy way for people to work it out for themselves?
No, that's a great question. I'm not convinced that you can do one day a week cheating. It soon becomes 2 days, 3 days, 4 days, and then you're back. You know, I just don't think it happens. You have to, it's all or none. Mm-hmm. I've made the point, as I think you're leading up to this, that when you go on this diet, you've got to get rid of your sugar addiction and the other addictions you mentioned. If you don't get rid of them, you won't survive on this diet. And in fact, we've got some scientific evidence for that. The people who reverse their diabetes by themselves, without doctors, without dietitians, were the ones who completely controlled all the addictions. And they had no craving for food, or they were able to accommodate it, to control that. And if you don't control that, you'll slip back again.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I think one of the reasons why we underestimate the incredible ability of this diet to cause weight loss is the clinical trials don't have sugar addiction programs in them. So you're asking people with sugar addiction to reverse their sugar addiction, get on this diet and stick with it. And you don't give them any advice how to do that. And of course it doesn't work. And I would guess 50% of the people on these clinical trials are sugar addicts, and they can, sure, for 3 months they can stay off the sugar. But then they start, and you'll see always the curves go like this. The weight loss comes off for 3 months, 6 months, and then it comes back again. And that's where the sugar addiction starts working through again. So if you want to help people, we have to address the sugar addiction.
Mm-hmm.
In my view, it's no question of moderation. It's all or nothing. And I'm exactly like you. It took me 14 months to stop adding sugar to my coffee or tea. I could stop the sugar on everything else, but in coffee and tea, I couldn't for 14 months. Now, if I taste sugar, I spit it out. It's got a terrible taste, sugar.
Yeah, I mean, I feel lucky in a sense that my immediate symptoms, if I eat sugar or starchy carbs, are severe. So I used to have heartburn, or I'm not sure it was heartburn, to be honest, but anyway, pain in my esophagus that was so bad that I had to sleep kind of semi upright with 5 pillows, and you know, would be awake half the night, and that would happen a few nights a week, and it was just dreadful, you know. And then as soon as I went low carb, for the first time in years, I could sleep flat. It was great. And if I eat sugar, starch, carbs again, then it comes back just like that. So
yeah.
In a way, it's I feel lucky that it's that bad. And it's the same with the sort of mental health side of things. Like, I can get the same sort of depression and anxiety and sort of strange intrusive thoughts if I eat differently, you know, and that happens almost immediately. So I've got that very powerful feedback loop, whereas other people, I feel, they might believe what you're saying. They might think, okay, in the long term, this is going to definitely be better for me. But we're in a toxic food environment where all this stuff is incredibly tasty, and you don't have that feedback loop that'll get you to stop straight away. And for those people, I think it's much more difficult in a sense.
Yeah, no, I think you're very right. It's great to have those symptoms come on immediately. What's interesting is that we normally say that the microbiome is causing it. Well, it can't change within one meal that you cause that. So that's a very interesting, how could it happen so quickly?
Mm-hmm. Still a mystery, and there's, you know, all sorts of theories about histamine release or particular types of fiber causing bacteria to grow, or, you know, wild and woolly theories. But all I know is that if I stay off the stuff, then I'm fine. So I do.
Yeah.
I was going to ask you, you grew up in South Africa, right? So
yes.
what was the food like growing up there?
Well, I was actually, you see, my mother came from a family that exported meat to New York from Liverpool, and that was the boats, the charter boats, those very big boats that used to travel between Liverpool and New York. Her father's company used to provide the meat on those boats. And then, of course, the boats stopped going because the airplanes came, so the meat industry collapsed. But my mother always fed me meat. We had offal. We would eat brains, sheep brains, kidneys, livers, pancreas, and I was raised on that. But then I went to boarding school, unfortunately, and so I started to get the carbs at boarding school. And then, but at home we would always get a cooked breakfast of eggs and bacon and haddock, nice Scottish food. And so I was raised more on a carnivorous diet. And I was the one who changed the family and told my father that, you know, that these weren't so good, he should be eating more carbs. And that was not the right advice. And then, particularly for someone who had diabetes, yeah.
And I guess that came in a sort of middle class setting where you were trained as a doctor and all the rest of it. But I think, you know, there's a lot of poverty in Scotland, but there's also a lot of poverty in South Africa. And I think the links between, you know, poor health outcomes and lower socioeconomic status is pretty obvious. And, you know, what do you think about the state of nutrition in South Africa? And, you know, what do you think can be done about improving it on a bigger scale?
Well, if you look at the Nguni tribes, where the people, for all African, South African people are raised, or from the Nguni communities who arrived in Southern Africa 1,000 years ago, and they brought cattle with them. Now, there's fantastic Nguni cattle. And the Nguni cattle were very dominant in certain provinces of South Africa until the Anglo-Boer War, when they were shot out by the British, because that's how you defeat the opposition. And so this population went from being meat-based, in my opinion, meat, chicken, and goat-based, to being, they were started to eat maize. And that's been the problem. So we have populations that eat maize. Most of their calories come from maize. And in fact, 40% of calories of all South Africans come from maize. And maize is nutrient poor, as nutrient poor as you can get. So what you have to do is you've got to fortunately reintroduce animals to the population. And it can be done. South Africa has got enough land to produce animals. But we haven't done it. We've gone the grain route, unfortunately. No.
And then
we have an Eat Better South Africa campaign for my foundation. And we show that South Africans can live on $3 a day, or what's that, a couple of pounds a day. And then they eat eggs, pilchards or sardines, offal, as I was raised on. Offal is very cheap. Fat from the fat going to the wealthy supermarkets is cut off and it's given away, so you can use that fat as your butter and other sources of fat. And then vegetables are still quite cheap in South Africa, so you can eat quite well, but you got to get away from the grains and the breads, as you know, and the sugars, and that's the difficulty.
Mm-hmm. There's a really interesting figure in the UK. She's called Jack Munro. She writes books for people who are kind of on the breadline, but want to, you know, a lot of her recipes are healthy.
But, yeah.
You know, she mainly sticks to vegetables. I think she's not a vegan herself, but she's approaching that. And I sometimes worry that recommending a lot of meat eating is seen as elitist and maybe just unattainable for a lot of people. But it's something that I really want to get into more of, is communicating how it doesn't have to be expensive.
Now, the fish is cheaper in this country. Meat is still very expensive. That is a reality. But offal isn't, so that one can eat offal. And most of these communities, when you speak to them about offal, they said, yeah, but our grandparents used to eat that. Mm-hmm. And then it became, because the white people didn't eat it, it was considered infidelity to eat it. So that's why it went off the menu. They started mimicking what the white people were eating. And of course, the white people were starting to eat this, the junk foods. And so that became the aspirational foods.
And so in the context of meat being reintroduced, I've been watching Alan Savory talk about this for a while now. And, you know, he considers global warming to be equivalent to desertification, and he considers the way to bring back grasslands and sequester carbon is to put ruminant animals on the desert land. What do you think about that? And what do you think about the alternative, which might be to produce protein sources that look like meat, but are made from either cultured meat or other proteins?
Yeah, I think we should stay natural. You know, I can't think, I've seen what these fake burgers are. They're just highly processed foods, and that, why would you think they're going to be healthy? I mean, how anyone can believe that humans who evolved to eat meat, that the meat can be taken out and now they're provided with this plant-based proteins, it's just not going to work. Plant-based proteins are not, you know, when I was in medical school, they were called second-class proteins. Now they're not called second-class proteins because that's dismissive of vegetarians. I mean, that's a fact. They are not as good a protein as animal proteins. So now, Alan Savory is fantastic. The problem is that you do need water to make his thing work. And I know that they've tried it in where there's sparse water supply and it becomes more difficult. It's not as successful. But to think that we can continue to eat grains forever, it's not going to happen. Within 50 or 60 years, the grain industry is going to collapse because the soil is so poor. And that's when your civilization really collapses. And people don't foresee that. Mm-hmm. That's another thing we're going to learn from history, is that all the civilizations collapse when they destroy the land.
Yeah, and it's the land recovers, but the populations take a lot longer, I guess.
Exactly right.
Well, it's been a really, really interesting talk. There's lots of other stuff I could ask about, but why don't you let everyone know where they can find you and what you want them to know?
Sure, Ali. So I'm active on Twitter, and my Twitter handle is @ProfTimNoakes, and I try to give information that's relevant and the new science as it evolves, and put you in touch with the people who I think are the minds that are driving the low-carb story. Then we have the Noakes Foundation, and you can go to the Noakes Foundation website and pick up other information. And then I write regularly for CrossFit, for the CrossFit website. And I'm spending quite a lot of time writing for them. And the series I'm doing now is on insulin resistance and diabetes. And if you read it, it hasn't been published yet. It's coming soon. But you'll see the whole story of how we got it wrong on diet. And I'll show you that it's diabetes and insulin resistance that is the problem. And that the other name that we haven't mentioned is a guy called Gerald Raven. And Raven described insulin resistance, and he worked it out. And the tragedy is that in the 1990s, he was on the verge of saying a low-carb diet reverses the metabolic syndrome. He had the evidence, but he didn't do it. And he didn't do it because at Stanford, he would have got nailed. For telling people to eat a high-fat diet, the cardiologist would have killed him, and his career would have been ended. And he stopped. He stepped back. But the point is, he did a remarkable work to show how insulin resistance is a driver of most of the chronic diseases. But where he made the error, it's not the insulin resistance; it's the high carbohydrate diet in the presence of insulin resistance that causes chronic disease. And the message is that we've got to address the high carbohydrate diet. We can't reverse insulin resistance. That's a genetic component that's made worse by high carbohydrate diets. But you've got to take out the foods. And the future of medicine is nutritional based. It may take a long time to happen, but that is the future.
Well, I'm really happy that you came on, and I'm delighted to be able to spread that message around a bit more. So thanks again.
My pleasure, Ali. Thanks for having me.
All right.
Bye. Cheers.
Thanks so much for listening, everyone. Please don't forget to jump over to iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts and hit the subscribe button. And please don't forget to leave a 5-star rating and review to get the podcast in front of more eyes. Every 5-star review will get a voucher for 25% off at paleocanteen.co.uk, which is my company and the show's sponsor. That's 25% off at paleocanteen.co.uk when you leave a 5-star review. It's appreciated.